It's The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of the Slate podcast, What Next TBD. I'm in for Tanzina Vega this month and joining you from my closet in Brooklyn. Thanks for spending some time with us. While essential workers risk their lives to bring medical care to those in need and to keep grocery stores stocked for everyone, a lot of us have been staying inside for weeks now to help stop the spread of COVID-19. That's important for public health, but for some people, that's keeping them closer to dangerous situations and further from help and resources. This is especially true for victims of domestic violence and child abuse. For many, support systems and resources that might normally be available are overwhelmed or are even more difficult to access now. And around the world, many governments and organizations are looking for solutions to protect vulnerable people unsafe in their own homes. Some women's shelters, for example, have found ways to stay open. Beth Sturman, the CEO of Laurel House, a domestic violence agency in Montgomery, Pennsylvania, says their shelters have been able to find alternative housing options, like hotels, for victims of domestic violence.
Anyone who calls who needs shelter related to domestic abuse and safety, we will be able to take care of. We have not had to turn anyone away.
So now I'm joined by two people to talk about why this moment is especially dangerous for some and the efforts worldwide to find solutions. Rachel Louise Snyder is the author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. And Nadare Salim is the CEO of the Children's Network of Southwest Florida. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Hello.
Rachel, I want to start with you. What has changed for survivors of domestic violence right now versus before this disease?
The biggest thing is that, you know, everybody is stuck inside. And so whatever stressors existed before COVID-19 are exacerbated right now. You might have financial pressures. You might have, pressures from your children being home at school. And so all those things are just sort of exacerbated. But you couple that with the fact that you cannot access resources. It's very difficult to do a safety plan when you can't leave your house, when you can't talk on the phone freely to someone who could help you form a safety plan, or when police won't enter your house to try to collect evidence, for example, if there is an incident. So there's just all kinds of pressures from all different places coming at people in this situation right now.
Nadare, have you seen an increase in reported incidents of child abuse in South Florida, where you're based, since the coronavirus outbreak began?
What we're actually seeing is an increase in the incidents and the maltreatments of domestic violence, alcohol abuse, and other substances in Southwest Florida.
And what are the main factors behind that? I mean, are they similar to what Rachel mentioned, people being cooped up inside?
Yes. And in addition, you know, our children are even further isolated since they're not in school. There are no after school programs. Their extended family is limited in their ability to visit. So the visibility increases vulnerability for our children. So limited visibility equals to increased vulnerability.
Rachel, when this pandemic first started, there was some fear that shelters wouldn't be able to stay open. Are we seeing that happen?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that because I've seen that reported in some media, but I actually, I've interviewed more than 36 people in the last 10 days or so, 2 weeks, and I have yet to come across any shelters that have had to close. Many of them have had to adapt, and as the woman from Laurel House said, lots of shelters are working with hotels to try to house not just victims or survivors of domestic violence, but also, you know, first responders or homeless people from the homeless population. So hotels are being called to work in the front lines, I guess, in that way. But also shelters have had to vastly adapt, right? You're talking about people living in communal housing who now have to isolate. And for children, that is incredibly difficult. Children are natural communal populations.
Yeah.
And so it's been very, very difficult for people. But it, just as the woman from Laurel House said, nobody is turning anyone away. In fact, I had a woman at a shelter in San Francisco say, you know, even if we're out of space, we will give them our office to sleep in. We will turn nobody away. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm finding more than shelters closing.
The French government has provided housing for some victims of domestic violence, and it seems like some states and organizations here in the U.S. are trying to do similar things. You mentioned talking to an organization. Do we know how well that's working?
Well, yeah, the French government contracted to rent hotel rooms for victims of domestic violence. That's something that we've always done here. I mean, that's long been a practice in Washington, D.C., for example, where I live. That's a very common thing to do. The difference is that we don't do it through our federal government, right? Our federal government really offers very few protections. So I'm seeing it in places. Chicago has done it. San Francisco is doing it. D.C. I'm seeing it, but it's through organizations and organizations which are really, really struggling financially right now. So they're putting themselves out in the hopes that funding will catch up with them in the future, in the near future. It's a kind of terrifying position to be in.
Nadara, you mentioned, you know, obviously kids out of school where they would come in contact with a mandatory reporter like a teacher or an administrator. Is it becoming harder to know if children are in an abusive or neglectful situation given kids out of school and kind of limited visits between other people who might be able to speak up on their behalf?
Yes, we're quite concerned about that. Actually, we're seeing the numbers of abuse reports have gone down across the state of Florida. But one effort we're making is for the children that are known to us, whether in our prevention programs, diversion, or in-home services or foster care, we have increased the frequency of our contacts. So prior to this, we would be visiting the children once every 30 days. Now we're trying to have contact with them once a week or once every 2 weeks, so that at least we have increased our eyes on the kids as one measure of protection. But yeah, we're quite concerned that maybe after this, we might have a surge in the number of reports just to make up for the lost time and the fact that our kids are not visible to the community at large.
That's so important what you said. And I want to just add that domestic violence victims will often stay in a situation until the children are hurt, right? It's when their children are threatened that makes them finally flee. You see that in cases over and over. And I just want to underscore what she said because it's so important, because children are really stuck, which means domestic violence victims are really stuck today. And when I talk to shelter workers or advocates or police officers, they're seeing the same thing, that calls are going down, but the extreme severity when they do finally get calls is going up. And so there's this disconnect between what appears to be happening, but what that actually means for our first responders.
Well, let's talk about kind of the options that people have then. I mean, I'm curious, Nadare, is it harder to place kids into different housing or move them out of a dangerous situation right now?
So, you know, as part of our preparation for this, we quickly got an inventory of all of our foster homes that had available beds or capacity, and we inquired, would you be willing to take new children or children who possibly have tested positive or come in contact with anyone? We did the same thing with our group homes, with our families who are relative caregivers, to try to increase the capacity. And so we kind of went into this with a little bit of a preparation in, you know, just in case we had a surge of kids coming into care. So far, you know, some areas of the state are struggling because if the children test positive or we have large sibling groups, it makes it difficult to place because families aren't sure, well, have these kids been exposed? You know, how do we know? And we can't quite quarantine every child that comes into care. We take all the precautionary measures that CDC and the Department of Health gives us. So we have not hit the crisis yet. But I'll tell you, one area that we're struggling with are the older youths who have a tendency to either run away or have some behavior problems and DJJ challenges. So that group is posing quite a challenge for us. So we're doing the best we can, and we're partnering with our faith community. The churches have really opened up their arms to us. So Between all of us coming together, the nonprofits, government, and the faith organization, so far we've been able to manage. And we're always calling out for new foster parents to join us.
Well, Rachel, you mentioned people being able to reach out and, you know, the idea that it's not as easy to make that phone call right now or to reach a hotline. What are you seeing in terms of both how kind of response groups and hotlines are adapting, but also whether technology, you know, is able to play a role here when it's more difficult to make that call?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I am seeing that response line advocates are having to adapt their language. So calls take a lot longer because they can only ask yes or no questions. Are you safe? Can you get out of the house right now? Things like that. And they troubleshoot, like, can you say that you've got a piece of mail to deliver for the neighbor that got delivered wrong, like something to buy them 5 minutes to go outside so that they can do just a tiny bit of safety planning. So that's one thing. Technology is certainly a help. There's a lot of apps out there that are geared toward different populations. I would recommend Yardley Love's mother. Yardley Love was the killed by the lacrosse player in Virginia, University of Virginia. The One Love Foundation has a lot of great resources and lots of different apps that they recommend on their website, but there's one in particular called My Plan, and it's all lowercase with a capital P, My Plan, because there's a lot of different My Plan apps, as it turns out, health and fitness and stuff. So it's that capital P that matters. And that helps victims to assess their own safety. But the other thing that I'm hearing people doing is to have a very small group of girlfriends or family members that you can reach out to and have a code word. Maybe you want to talk about your grandmother's cake, and when you mention the type of cake, it's a code to call 911. Or, you know, talk about your pet. Have some sort of, work out some sort of language so that you can reach out safely for help. It's just a very scary time in which we really don't know what the outcome is going to look like.
Rachel and Nadare, thank you both so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Louise Snyder is the author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. And Nadare Salim is the CEO of the Children's Network of Southwest Florida. Stay with us. This is The Takeaway.